Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we have a special guest, George, will be joining us. And we also have Peter Moon. And Peter is the author and publisher as well of SkyBooksUSA.com. And the and he's the author of the entire series, a Montauk series, a number of books. And one we may talk about tonight will be the Transylvania Sunrise. There he is now. George, I think you're with us.
Yeah, good evening, Leo.
How you doing, George?
Peter. Fine. How you doing, Lila?
I'm just fine. How are you? I hear Lola and your other dog.
I'm gonna put Peter on the line too. He just came right on.
Oh, great, great.
Hello.
Hello, Peter. Oops.
Whoop.
Hello.
No, you didn't do it yet. There it is.
Hello.
Peter. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, we can hear you just fine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Leo.
Welcome. I can hear you also, Peter.
Good, George. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's always nice speaking with you, my friend. It's been a long time.
Well, I was grateful that you could be on tonight, Pete, with us, and I told you earlier, I read the entire series and a bunch of great stuff that you put together, tonight I wasn't sure what we were going to talk about. I think we had mentioned the Transylvanian Sunrise book and some of the interesting aspects of that. But did you have anything else that you wanted to specifically speak about?
Well, there are some things that we discussed earlier today about the Transylvania theme.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was fascinating, too, and you might want
to... How about the link to the Blu-ray?
Well, yes, I'm going to get to that, but I just thought, you know, I might reiterate who exactly I am for your listeners who might not be familiar with.
Well, I had mentioned it.
Tell a little bit about yourself, Peter.
Yeah. Okay, my name is Peter Moon. I'm the co-author of the Montauk Project: Experiments in Time with Preston Nichols, a book about time experiments that were conducted on Long Island that are very intriguing. You know, the cutting edge of time, and of course I've written several books corroborating or substantiating that not only were there such things that took place there, but it's related to what you call quantum affinity or quantum synchronicity that has gone to some very many intriguing areas, one of which includes this bizarre connection to Transylvania, which I had the opportunity to visit the heart or capital of Transylvania last summer. And this was very interesting because it was all made possible to me by my friend Dr. David Anderson. And Dr. David Anderson appeared on the scene on August 11th, 1999, when he showed up at one of our local meetings on Long Island, and he was a scientist who had a time travel research laboratory right here on Long Island in Smithtown Hotbog area. And he has been working on time experimentation. He was made a big announcement on Art Bell on January 31st, saying he was actually putting humans in the time chamber.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yes, and anybody can go to YouTube and hear the Art Bell interview with him or go on to the Coast to Coast website. And Art asked some intriguing questions, pushed the envelope. I had conducted the first interview with him in like 5 years or something like that. He'd been out of touch with Sandy Sabatini on Other World Radio and Rick Smith, who hosts that. I was co-hosting with him that night, and he was coming out of the woodwork and explaining stuff. And he was also with us at Montauk a couple weekends ago. We had a sacred journey out there with the medicine man of the Montauk Indians, who returned to Montauk for the first time in 30 years. And,
wow.
And David Anderson joined us and made a presentation of time, which he also showed us a scene of the time chamber with this flower speeding up at a rapid pace. So that was quite an exciting thing for everybody who participated.
Wow.
And it was monumental to get David to come to Montauk for a day and participate. He was very enthused about it, and he had a great time. But back to the Transylvania theme, as I say, this is just a little bit of an intro to who I am. It was very short, and David Anderson. And he invited me to Romania in 2008 to a conference called Atlanticron. And Atlanticron is a grouping of science fiction writers, artists, scientists, and it's a program for the brightest kids in Romania who apply to come to this program, and they learn all sorts of things, like, you know, they work on making Tesla coils and artistic projects where they mix science with art and science fiction writing contests, kickboxing. I was teaching Qigong there last year. I was lecturing on my books and whatnot, which are also published in Romanian. So it's something that he invited me to in 2008, and he also provided what he called a cultural tour in that year, where I was able to see the Sphinx in Romania. And this next year, all the funding had been cut, the corporate funding that was providing for it. So, you know, I raised money through my newsletter by offering special deals to my, you know, subscribers and anybody for that matter who wanted. This year I'm going to be offering a DVD of my 2 years in Romania and Wow. some of the adventures, including the Sphinx. And but this last year in 2009, I went to the holy site, the heart of Transylvania, the capital of ancient Transylvania, which is called Sarmizeja Tuza. And there's a clock, which you call an astronomical clock, that is a bunch of wooden, they're not stakes, they're wooden, I don't know what you'd say, they're not they're like pilings, except that they're square. And they make a tonal signature, and they have different shadows. It's a very strange calendar for the way we would think, the way
it
works.
Is it like Stonehenge?
It's like Stonehenge, except it's not rock. It's made out of wood. There are rocks around the wood, and there are rocks all around the place. And the place has been refurbished. At some point, somebody, you know, came and enhanced it so it looked more like it used to. But a lot of the stones are original, and there's aqueducts and this sort of thing. And this is the center of this. Now, when I went there the first year, all of the professors and esoteric people said, you must go there. This is where you want to go. So I went the second year because it's not easy to get there. You know, there's not like buses don't go up there. And I had to go with a very special friend I met, Nicole Veselkovsky. She's like a really brilliant student who's getting her PhD right now in diplomacy and international business. And she had volunteered to take me. And we went there with another very nice lady, Christina Ballin, who's going to be a dentist next year. She's studying to be a dentist. They both speak English well. They've both been to the United States. And they took me into the backwoods of Romania, where we stayed, in Transylvania, where we stayed in a monastery of the old Orthodox Church, which the abbot there, or the bishop, is an exorcist. So the odds of going to Transylvania and staying with an exorcist are probably pretty rare, but I did. And he took care of us, drove us around, and made sure that we got a ride there. He didn't go with us. And we were told to spend 3 days there. We could only spend 1 day. And it was ironic that when we talk about synchronicity, when I arrived there, I was talking to one of the monks, and Nicole was translating for me, and he said that the first stone for this monastery was laid on August 11th, 1999. That was the very day that I met David Anderson. And here we were 10 years later going to the holy site in Transylvania.
And on August the 11th?
Yeah, August the 11th.
Okay.
Yes, and which I guess if you take the numerological symbolism, it's 8-11-11, which would mean a gateway to 11-11, which is, you know, we're not going to discuss 11-11 tonight, but it could be representative of, you know, two DNA spirals, life, God, the infinite, the gateway to the infinite, however you want to look at it. But
just curious in the time.
Yeah, this is symbolic, and of course it also coincides with the biorhythm of the Montauk and Philadelphia experiments, which occurred on August 12th, and that biorhythm occurs on 2 days either side of August 12th.
Right.
So this was right in the midst of this, and what's important, the synchronicity that occurred there was just remarkable in and of itself, and there's many ties to it. But because we were talking earlier, Leo, today, and what will fascinate George, because he wasn't privy to the conversation or the recent findings I've been coming up. This is a lot of interesting synchronicity. I was told that if I go to this place in Transylvania, it will be a deep spiritual experience. So I'm saying, okay, great. And it's the residue is still with me because...
You know, Peter, if I can break for a minute here, I think the synchronicity is when I spoke with Leo earlier today, you know, he mentioned you. And, of course, there's a few things lately that brought you to mind in my mind's eye. In the meanwhile, you know, I've been trying to follow your work and also David Anderson's work. And to be truthful, there's so much materials that I cover here. I've been reviewing, you know, the audio tapes of David's talk on the nightly show.
The Art Bell Show?
The Bell Show, right. And, right. You know, it's a matter of just digesting this. You know, as I go along here, and you know, besides, I have three books on my bookcase that I'm reviewing, and you know, it's just so much materials. But you know, I haven't had time to touch base with you and find out how your work is done. But I'm very anxious to David Anderson's, and I think the synchronicity now that this stuff is coming to part. But go ahead. You know, I'm just curious on the synchronicity here that's falling into place, and that's one thing I laugh about. There's so
well,
much.
If you remember it, you know, you can interrupt me again, and we'll go from there. But with the synchronicity, it gets, you know, it increases exponentially here, as I'm about to say, and that's because I didn't realize the synchronicity I'm about to indulge in with you was prefaced by this site, this holy, so-called holy experience in Transylvania, which I was just going there as an innocent witness. And I was indeed rewarded.
It sounds like a novel, you know, the way you're explaining your trip and so forth.
Well,
but go ahead, my friend.
It's very interesting because when I went there, this is where it got some teeth. When I went to Romania the first time, David not only had agreed through the World Genesis Foundation to provide my transport and tour, he says, you can bring a guest with you. I wanted somebody to do the filming, and I couldn't get anybody, the local people that I knew, I couldn't get them to come. It was frustrating. So I got this girl out in San Francisco who I knew, Tantra Bensko, who was a Tantra teacher, and I didn't think she'd be able to go. She jumped at the chance. And Tantra is, of course, a very gifted teacher of the Tantric arts and whatnot, and I know her as a friend, and she'd been a fan of my work. So we're over there and whatnot. But so she couldn't make it the second year. But she had written to me just recently about, she says, do you have any fiction you've ever written? I'd like to put in an anthology. I said, well, you know, before I got started in all this, I wrote a book about a fiction story about Transylvania. And I said, I read it to her over the phone. She loved it. And her work is lucid fiction, where fiction becomes reality and vice versa. So this is what started the theme of what I'm about to tell you. And she was then dialoguing with another woman who... it was sort of a three-way thing. We were writing sort of creative fiction, and they were talking about Transylvania County and Transylvania Colony and Transylvania Purchase. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, and I was a witness to these exchanges that were going on, and I looked them up myself. Now, the Transylvania Purchase was done in 1975 by Daniel Boone on behalf of a guy named Richard Henderson. And what was being proposed was the Transylvania Colony. It was to be the 14th colony of the United States, and it was going to be called Transylvania Colony, purchased by the famous Daniel Boone. I said, this is bizarre. And I'm going, what is Transylvania? And, of course, now most of that is now the state of Kentucky.
Oh.
And Kentucky is known for its, in this region, I didn't know it at the time, but I said, is this the region where the blue bloods of Kentucky, the Fugates, where people are born with blue skin and the blue race? Now, I've written pretty extensively about the blue race in other books where they that I've written where they were Rh-negative race with copper-based blood that were tangibly connected to the Mars before Mars' orbit, you know, was such that they were losing the sun, and they came here and basically went into the caves, and there's quite a substantiation for that. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to go into that right now. And, of course, I thought that this theme that I put was connecting the blue rays to the white gold was twisted and debased by many of the mind control victims who came out and talked about shape-shifting into reptilians and this sort of thing.
Yes.
I thought this degraded the scholarship and the information, although there's certainly that potential to happen. It appeals to the lowest common denominator, and it took away from any progressive research as far as I was concerned. But this Transylvania colony got me to thinking. I said, well, why is it connected to – what's the connection between Transylvania in America and in Romania? Now, it's very interesting because there's a Transylvania University in Kentucky, and it so happened that the lady who sponsored and hosted this Montauk Sacred Journey we did on April 9th, 10th, and 11th of this year at Montauk happens to be from that area. And right after she finished, she went down to that area. So she's down there and is going to be investigating that area, which is where her family lives. She's going to be there for a few months. And there's a lot of archaeological relics apparently down there that are just sitting there waiting to be looked at, but the people don't know where they are, and the backwoods people aren't always obliging to outsiders. But anyway, the point is what is the connection between Transylvania? The dictionaries, the encyclopedias don't give us any clues that I could see. And Transylvania is, of course, a word that was in the lexicon of humanity at that point. It was well known as the place where so many of the Europeans came from. Well, I could only do it with synchronistic association and I guess what you call from metaphysical literature and also historical literature is a character called Saint Germain. Saint Germain was a prince of Transylvania, and the Rakosny family is who he was, and he was brought up in Italy, and I think the town was called Germain, or when he took on the name of the town, Saint Germain. And he was seen through history. He was is historically recorded as a teacher of Napoleon, and I believe it was in a war college, and he was known as a financier. He was a Rosicrucian, and according to Manly P. Hall's The Secret Destiny of America, he was the reincarnation of Francis Bacon, the man who wrote the Shakespearean plays and who wrote a book called The New Atlantis, and he, you know, sort of featured this new continent in The New Atlantis. So you have Saint Germain also now is recorded in the Rosicrucian documents as having been at the American Revolution in 1775, right when Daniel Boone made this purchase. He was connected to the Knights Templar. He was connected to the, of course, I said the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons. He would have been connected to the Bavarian Illuminati as well, and he was said to have been present at the Declaration. Of course, you have Ben Franklin, who was also a Rosicrucian, and connected with many of these other secret societies. So you have the connection of a secret society and ostensibly creating a colony where this race of blue people had been known, and the land was purchased from the Cherokees. And the Cherokees had a legend or oral history that there were blue people there. And one of the Cherokees, a man named Blue Otter, had said that these it was not true that the Cherokee had wiped these people out. They went into underground caves. Mm-hmm. And they live in caves because their skin is sensitive to this. Now, you also have the character Aleister Crowley, who appears in my work as a synchronistic connection. He went down to Kentucky because of all these caves. He was so thrilled by these caves. So this is, what is this thread coming through about Transylvania that was... And this ancient blue race, which would seem to be the characters who created this chamber in under the Sphinx in Romania, that is the subject of the Transylvania Sunrise book.
Getting into the Transylvania Sunrise book a little bit more, what fascinated me was that was in the Sphinx, they actually had it was a holographic archive of,
right.
of the history of humanity, or the history of the world, or I don't even know if it was the history of the universe. Maybe you can clarify that. It's been a while since I read it, but...
Well, the book says it's the history of the world, but say if you looked at the history of the world in that chamber, and I looked at it, and George or Lila looked at it, it'd be a little bit different for each one of us, because there is a resonance with the DNA that's sort of in who you are that's going to want to see different things. Perhaps it's, you know, connected to your, you know, your life experience. So you might see the, you know, different play. You know, just like if we were watching TV, we'd all be watching different things. Sometimes we'd watch the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's,
that's how we view a fractal.
But everyone's interpretation can be different, no matter what an event is or a thing is.
For sure. So it was
like Lila and I, we'll watch the same movie. I can't stand it. She likes it. I hate it. Or I like it and she hates it. So it's like, or she'll fall asleep through it. But it's like, you know, that's the different ways I can see how people
are. You see things, life through your own glasses, through your own experience.
Yeah,
and,
but I was fascinated by it. I remember the scenes that you described in that book as how they this cavern or under I guess it was under the Sphinx and there was this huge.
But someone related that to you, right?
Well, this was not. Let Leo finish. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, what I saw what I remember in the book. Was a very, and I have to say it was very vividly written. I enjoyed reading the book, but they described the holographic archives as for everywhere you turned there was another. I mean, there was a description of the reptile and from the reptile to the, you know, of all of evolution and the different all kinds of scientific evidence and everything else. It was placed there by an alien race.
Well, that was evident, yeah. And just to clarify, just first to address Lila's thing, is that, no, I did not write that. It was Radu Sinemar who wrote the book and translated it into English, and then I further translated it into American English from Euro English. And then he told the story, and there was one part which was a holographic history of the world. There were other tables which would read out your DNA, and that would, whereas like it would show the star system that it came from and the prototype for a certain type of race or species, and you could also mix species, whether it be human and reptilian or human and, you know, salamander like or whatever. So there was a DNA template and bag of, you know, alphabet soup. You could mix up, so to speak.
Fascinating, yeah.
And this was just, that book was written after just about 3 weeks of exploring it. So we don't know how much it's been explored since then, and how much the lid has been placed very tightly on that area.
Because I believe there was one area there that he couldn't describe. There was not the entire place was closed off. But I mean, these certain rooms were open to him, but there are others that I think that he wasn't able to get into. Is that correct or no?
Well, more so, there were three tunnels that had not been pursued at that point.
One went all the way to Iraq or something. I mean,
that's correct.
Iraq. Mm. I mean, from Romania to Iraq and all these different. You know.
There was one also in the Giza Plateau, wasn't there?
Yeah, one went to the Giza Plateau, one went to Iraq, and eventually went on to Tibet and Mongolia, and where they were similar installations. And, of course, one of the theories of the Blue Race, and of course the Native Americans, is that there's vast underground tunnels beneath the whole world, and you can travel from one to another. And this is how they travel. You can even travel in underground rivers if you know the way. Go ahead.
Peter, we were speaking with Preston Nichols, about a month and a half ago, and the question was raised, you know, the tunnel systems that are there in Transylvania, you know, could they possibly have an entrance there at Montauk? And Preston saying that there was some kind of a entrance to the underground system, but I was talking about a direct entrance, I think, to the same tunnel system, you know, that we've been talking about.
There's certainly that possibility. I know that back in the early days, before there was a Montauk Project book, that George and I would listen to Preston and whatnot, and the stories were that there were, you know, old underground tunnels and trains, you know, like tubes from old Atlantean times, so to speak, that were way underneath Long Island, very deep, and they probably connected the whole planet. One of the things that Radu stressed in one of his letters to me was that this inner Earth civilization was real. And it would stand to reason that if the legends of the blue race are, you know, even just partially true, that they would be residing in this inner core of the planet, mm-hmm. and they would have worked that technology out long ago, and that this is what we're dealing with, because he did say that his boss, Caesar, who is his boss in the book and sets him up to do all this, he was very sad in one of his letters he wrote to me because he had left. He had departed. His boss had departed. He no longer had him, and his boss went to be an ambassador to the beings in the inner Earth. Now, that's all he said. It was vague. I don't know what that means, except the implication would be that it, from what we've learned now, that it might be this blue race or some derivative of them.
But so his boss, Caesar, became an ambassador to the underground race.
Yes, and what exactly that consists of, you know, I can't say because I don't know.
And you want to ask an ambassador for whom?
Ostensibly an ambassador for the Department Zero of Romania, or the Romanian government, so it would seem.
Yeah. I was surprised.
Well, if I can, I'd like to turn this back to Crowley.
Yep.
Now, when you were describing or talking about the blue rays, Peter, you know, it reminded me of the Crowley Chronicles. And, you know, going back to Aleister Crowley, what part Aleister Crowley played with the Montauk. And knowing that part of the magic he was performing was hooking into some kind of a time portal and using Montauk as the focus point.
Well, but the thing about Aleister Crowley, he had a lot of linkages to occult phenomena, and that includes spirit phenomena. Whether you believe in spirits or not, it certainly emulated spirits phenomena. You talk about disembodied creatures talking, old gateways. And when you get to the archetypal spiritual architecture of what things are made of, he was playing with, that's kind of what his genetics and his predisposition put him at. So he was a transmitter between ancient experience and modern experience with his own will, which was, you know, of course, could create havoc at times.
Yes.
And so, you know, you're saying he's using time portals. Well, he certainly, his name and his, you know, vestige certainly surfaced when I began to investigate this project. I couldn't get away from his resonance or psychic.
Well, I'm just watching. I'm watching the synchronicity of following this time pattern. And, you know, we're talking about Crowley, but we're also talking about David Henderson's work. And it's all for real.
Well, it is real. And David is, of course, the technological scientist who's brilliant beyond belief. And people don't even recognize his genius. But that's okay with him. He says he can get a lot more done with that, and he doesn't, you know, need his ego stroked because he says it's not productive and it's a waste of time.
Do you think he's the reincarnation of someone?
I don't think that's a particularly significant point or something to stress. Because you know it's you know it's kind of like saying you're related to Paul McCartney. So what? Can you sing and produce records like he does? You know, it's an ancient time. It's more interesting if he was. I do believe, based upon, if I were to take the Montauk legends and Al Bielek and part of the reality of the Anderson family, that's also part real, is that the Andersons are the guardians of time, and that time went wrong at Montauk, and the Anderson family are the ones that will come back and fix it. Because one thing I would like to share, George, you remember our friend Maya?
Yes.
Now, Maya is a woman I'd actually seen slip in time, and I witnessed it in front of the old building there at where we used to have the psychotronics meetings in Farmingdale with our friend Frank, who I haven't heard of in years. And I witnessed this. I don't know. Frank was with me when I witnessed it. I saw her kind of move in time, and she's the only person I've ever seen, and she joined us there. And she had a lot of challenges in her life dealing with multiple timelines and stuff. And she said, for the first time, after seeing David's lecture, presentation, and then being with the medicine man who was out there, she sees a new hope. She says, I see hope. I finally see hope. In other words, that things are going to get fixed out there. And that's, of course, bringing the medicine of the Montauk Indians back there, the medicine man who hasn't been out there in 30 years. They've been kicked off that ground for hundreds of years.
And,
so
Peter, you're right. You're right. It is. I mean, the hair in the back of my head stood up. And she's right.
Yeah.
I found that a couple of years ago. There has been some redemption on that. And, there's a good ending.
I wanted to, I think it's a good point to bring up a little background on that, because in your book, and I believe it's in the Montauk Book of the Living, you mentioned that area and how many, and it was called the Valley of the Pyramids.
Well, it wasn't called the Valley of the Pyramids. It was the there were pyramids at Montauk at one point.
Oh, yeah, but the Indians called it the Valley of
the
Pyramids or something. And I think in the book you also mentioned that Thomas Jefferson got involved in that area to try to translate or try to transcribe and translate their language.
Yes, he did. He did write a translation of their language, which got lost in the Potomac, apparently by somebody who stole it. The trunk went into the Potomac, if that's true. But he was interested, and he was a key player in 1775 in Virginia, which was one of the states which canceled the Transylvania colony. The Virginia and North Carolina didn't want it because they claimed the land for themselves.
Oh,
it eventually became the land of Kentucky, which has a very interesting name, which they say means the land of blood. A bloody land for over Indian fights over it, but it also is like Kontaki. I've heard it as a Japanese title, like Kontiki, which is the creator god, Kontiki.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also other possibilities, which, I'm not going to go
into. How about
into.
West Kentucky?
Well, this is more East Kentucky.
Okay.
Eastern.
This may not have anything to do with it, but since it is Kentucky. I recall that the 95 or more percent of the Kentucky economy was derived from hemp. All right, and that was also the amazing part about it was, of course, the colonies were 90% of the economy of their colonies was hemp, but the finest hemp grown was actually in Kentucky.
Well, what does that have to do with Kentucky?
Well, it just for some reason it Kentucky happened to be not only a great place to grow this stuff, but it also had some other significance that obviously I didn't know about the Transylvanian thing.
When somebody brings up hemp, it is never irrelevant to our culture. I can understand why you might think that, Lila. But having grown up in one of the hemp capitals of America, which is California, Northern California,
right.
it's hemp is there's a whole book on hemp that it would solve our fuel problems if you grow hemp.
Oh,
it burns
it's a
fuel.
A marvelous drug, but or a plant.
Well, part of it is the hemp is a real wonderful product. And then there's the hemp that's medicinal. It's just been demonized. But I don't know what exactly it has to do with Kentucky.
Well, the reason I say this is because this was a...
Well, they grow some good stuff in Kentucky. That's
the
point.
The fertility of Kentucky soil or whatever it was conducive to hemp. And that was it was a major source. It still is today a major grower. Of hemp, well, actually marijuana, in that sense, of mostly female plants. But it just fascinated me to know that Kentucky was somehow not only created. A blue race and this magical kind of mystical kind of connection, but it also happens to be one of the most fertile one of the most fertile areas for hemp production in the world.
Yeah, it can grow. The one thing about hemp is it can grow in any soil.
Yeah, but Lila, I'm not talking about that. It's quality hemp. I mean, you can grow crap hemp, but, you know, quality hemp.
Well, yes, and this is very important because right now hemp is going to be, it looks like it's going to be relied on to California to help get them out of their budget deficit.
Right.
And it could also help poor areas like Kentucky, just like, you know, the people have taken to using gambling to raise money,
right.
And it's still not enough money. So I would imagine that the states are going to start, you know, investing in what is now crime, organized crime.
Yeah.
You just legalize it. The states will start legalizing it because they have to out of force. And, of course, the U.S. government comes down on hemp growing almost harder than anything in the world, and one has to wonder why they come down on it so vigorously. And even despite that, they couldn't stop the hemp in California, which if you're walking, I was walking down the street in Venice Beach last year, and the girls, and we might be shocked on the East Coast, but they sit there, you know, would you like some, would you like a prescription to get some marijuana, medical marijuana? You know, you walk into the store, and the doctor will say, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I got a headache." "Oh, we'll prescribe some hemp. It'll cost about $100. I don't take marijuana myself, but I'm saying it's very readily available for a very steep price.
Mm-hmm.
But it's universal. Anybody can get it in California, and we don't have that in New York or the East Coast. But it's flagrant, and it's they can't stop it. It's
well,
been legalized
this way usually." That's what happens.
Well, there was a wonderful, wonderful book I read many years ago, and it was called the Encyclopedia of Hemp, and it had a tremendous number of a lot of information in it.
Yeah, but folks, I don't want to keep you. I don't let you forget here. Let's don't get sidetracked. Kentucky is more has more to do with this than hemp.
I'm working on this because I just wanted to isolate that for a moment and see if why Kentucky. I mean, it obviously has a spiritual aspect to that area, and obviously has more of a, more of a significance, okay, than just pot smokers. I mean, but
Let me bring up another interesting thread. Let me bring up a very interesting thread about Kentucky.
Yeah.
Is there are a lot of place names, and I know Peter Lavenda brought it up in one of his books, more tied to the occult. I forget which book it was, but he brought it up. I didn't think he took the connection far enough, but then he's not privy to all the things I've been studying. So, but the thing is that King Arthur, there's a lot of place names for King Arthur in Kentucky. And, of course, what I had read in a work by Alan Wilson was that King Arthur and Prince Madoc, who was the Welsh prince who came and opened up America to the Welsh, they came over here 400-500 A.D., which is coincidentally the same time the history of the world shuts off in that Transylvania Sunrise book. They said it cuts off in about 400-500 A.D. And this is the same time approximately when Prince Madoc and King Arthur, according to this writer, Alan Wilson, came over and they ended up in Kentucky. They came through Alabama, up the Mississippi, ended up in Kentucky. And I later deduced that the name Montauk and Madoc were very probably transliterations of each other, Madoc and Montauk, because there was a Montauk Pharaoh, according to the oral history, who was the whole Pharaoh of all of America. And, of course, Prince Madoc was regarded as the head of the Aztecs, according to one, many stories. And he gave this black... I forget what you call it, the shoe stone, to his family, which was handed down and eventually ended up in the hands of John Dee, the occultist who was so famous with working for Queen Elizabeth I and setting up the British Empire.
Now, was this...
Fascinating stuff.
Was this supposed pharaoh an indigenous people?
Say that again, please.
Was the pharaoh of North America supposedly an indigenous person?
Oh, yes, definitely. But you see... If you study the history of blue bloods or so-called blue bloods in England, they were always trying to marry into indigenous people, which was your Moorish lineage. If you see King George III, who suffered from blue bloods disease, porphyria, In other words, he urinated purple. And he has got the most, I guess, extensive historical records of his blue bloods disease, porphyria, and he was studied. And he was the king right when all this Daniel Boone stuff was happening in 1775, King George III. He was married to Queen Charlotte. And if you see her portraits, what I put in that book, she's a mulatto, a Moorish lady, and she would have had the royal blood, which is Charlotte is part of the Carolinian name, or, you know, which we know from the Merovinians, the vine of the Moors.
Actually, King George was mad.
He was mad when he was having his fits. I don't think he was mad all the time. It got progressively worse. I think he had his good days and his bad days, but he eventually was, had to be restrained, to put it mildly.
Yeah. And the blue blood. Let's go back for that a minute. The blue blood race is tied with all of royalty. Is that correct? Around the world?
Well, yes, that's where the French called it Sacré Bleu, the sacred blue.
Now, how did they tie that in with, I'm probably getting into something that I didn't really understand it, but the Christ lineage, all right, that they talk about, the blue bloods were supposed to, some of the blue bloods were supposed to also be the descendants of Christ, all right?
Well, that's more of the Merovinian story, history, legend, whatever you want to call it, and the Merovinians claim to be, and there are different versions of it, and there is the European version, and there's a lot of bric-a-brac around the Europeans and people that are the think they are the custodians of this bloodline and whatnot, but there's a lot of occult significance around it. But basically, the Merovinian lineage or dynasty is supposed to have come from the Cathars or the Cathars.
Okay.
And they actually came from Bulgaria, migrated into France. They were the Phoenician Empire, the same people, really, originating in, there's a very ancient tie-in to Atlantis in Bulgaria, which I'm just uncovering now. I'm going to be going there this summer. But these people have been linked or tied as the receptacles of the Three Marys, which is celebrated, you know, at the end of October every year, and the big gypsies come from all over the world to celebrate the arrival of the Three Marys, and the Mary gave, the mother of Jesus gave birth to Sarah Kali, or Sarah, who was the supposed daughter of Jesus. And
so
that
Lawrence Gardner writes about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't take anything he said with anything more than a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
I would believe it's all, you know, I wouldn't take anything he said with anything but a grain of salt. But the thing is, the lineage of these, and the guys who write the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Lincoln is
right.
One of the names. I don't remember the other names.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very well-known authors. For the Holy Blood, Holy Grail book, they talk about the great mystery, and well, they talk about the Merovinians as having an imposter bloodline, and the major domo takes over, and he takes over the bloodline he was the custodian of the household, so it's an imposter bloodline. The original bloodline being named after Merovinian, which is phonetically very obviously the vine of the Moors, and the Moors were, you know, are dark, and of course you have black Madonnas worshipped all over Europe and Africa, the Black Madonna. And then the mysterious thing, we're tying it to Jesus, where you really tie into the symbology of Jesus, is they say there was this, the vine of the Moors, or the Merovinians, come from the Kinotaur. And nobody knows what the Kinotaur is. The Kinotaur is basically a creature with five. It's a five-pronged creature, like a starfish. And, of course, I point out in more than one of my books, but the whole symbolism of the five is the pentagram, which is the sacred name of Jesus. And this is the great hidden Da Vinci Code that you'll never hear about in the Da Vinci Code, is that the sacred name of Jesus is the five Hebrew letters, Yod-Heh, Shin, Vav-Heh, which transliterated becomes Yeshua, and then further transliterated into Jesus, Iesus and Jesus. And this is the pentagram, which represents the four elements of fire, air, water, and earth, with Shin, which is the secret code of the Freemasons. And you won't see this in any books except mine, pretty much. Crowley wrote about it, but not as elaborately as I did. And the Shin is, of course, got meanings in different languages, but it's a letter which means tooth in Hebrew, but that comes from the boar's tooth, because the boar was their totem. That's why they don't eat pig meat. And the has a crescent tooth. And Shin means moon in the Mideast. That's what Shinar was, the capital of ancient Babylon, Shinar.
Now, you're moving right along very, very quickly, Peter, and I wanted to mention where we're headed, because what fascinated me was this connection with the pig, okay, and how Christ was actually how can I say this? In your book, you talked about how the blue bloods they had to diminish their race in order to survive, okay, in order to survive, so they used the pig. Was the pig DNA in order to do that? All right, I may be getting that wrong. I read it a lot,
no, more or less, you're right. There's legends of Abraham actually splicing the DNA together, and when I say splicing it, they don't use that word. Splicing is
right.
Combining the genetics of a pig. I mean of a cat, a dog, and some other animal to make the pig. I forget what the other animal is, and they basically he creates a pig. Which is
exactly. This is the medium that allowed the blue bloods to survive, right?
And or combine with the existing Cro-Magnon man or whatever was here,
right.
To survive and be able to be compatible with the outdoors. And part of that feature is melanin, because melanin is what protects us from the sun, our skin from the sun, and Celtic people have too little melanin to be protected from the sun, people who live in northern areas, and of course, this is where you get into the dark people having better protection of the sun and higher intelligence as well, and there's, of course, the genetics are deliberately degraded to make them dumber, because we've lost the whole Moorish culture in this process, which is a degradation of an ancient culture that was great, wonderful, and tolerant. And, of course, you see this in the Bible and in Egyptian history, where there were exoduses from Egypt. The Bible mentions the third exodus from Egypt, which is the one that Moses is famous for, over a disease that is written in the Talmud known as Zarat, which means... sort of means the wrath of God. You get this skin condition where your skin breaks out in white pustules and white skin patches. So you get the impression from reading this that everybody was melanated and dark and or blue, and we turned into the white race.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I found that to be incredibly fascinating. But the other thing was about the use of the pig again, and how actually... The pig represents the you go even deeper in stating how the pig represents the savior, all right, of humanity, of the race, or savior of humanity, if you will, but because of that, and that everything then there's, I don't know if it was in the Talmud or where it was, but the first mention of it wasn't Jesus; it was the Savior, basically, and that Savior was the pig. Right?
Well, yes, symbolizes the way to live, and of course, the pig was sacrificed at the Yule, and they put an apple in his mouth. You know, if you've seen that in cartoons and maybe in old medieval movies, where they get the pig, there. And in Romania to this day, they slaughter the pig on Christmas. The families will slaughter their own pig, and is the sacrifice of the pig, which is, the savior concept at the Yule. But the reason the apple is put in the mouth is because if you slice an apple or a pear transversely, you will get a pentagram. You will see a pentagram, and so that's why it has. It's the five-pointed star, which represents the sacred name of Jesus. And that Masonic word, they call it a word. It's the hidden word, but it's really a letter in Hebrew. Shin, it is. You see it in Japan, where it means spirit or heart. It can mean, you know, in spirit, in the word Shinto, the religion is the spirit of the Tao, Shin Tao. So we have Shin meaning heart. It means spirit. It means change, and it's the principle of adaptability, flexibility, and of course, if you have ultimate flexibility over the elements, you have a resurrection, and this is how someone in the personage of a Christ could make miracles occur, because he literally is that change, that spirit, that spark of life, and of course. What Christianity does, it humanizes this principle and dramatizes it and creates this whole drama which corresponds to astrological events and either historical events or alleged historical events that, you know, people focus on this one point in time and this one incident in time as having a lot more importance than, say, if you study the Kabbalah and understand its constant repetition, and some of these repetitions are going to repeat. Like, we watch football games every year, and it climaxes in the Super Bowl every year, you know? So it's like, you know, you have big points in history where principles repeat, like wars break out, tornadoes, disasters, and this is a repetition of an esoteric principle that is astrologically precise in the time of the birth and death of Christ.
Yes.
I see. It's fascinating. But before we wind up here, I'd like to get back to the concept which the book was based on, a Montauk book of the living anyway, was synchronicity. And that, I mean, you seem to, what I loved about this book was that it was more of a revelation to you when you wrote it, that how you linked everything started to come together as you started to quest for these questions and so on your journey, and the amazing people and events that came into your life. To this day, I want to ask you now: how do you find? Are you even more convinced of the synchronicity of our existence? And how it works with the universal type of with the universal consciousness, if you will.
It works in its own time. So, in other words, you can push it to an extent by studying subjects and looking them up. But things seem to occur in their own time. Who would have thought I'd end up on August 11th, 1999, in the heart of Transylvania, 10 years to the day I met David? And as I said, that church or that body of church people hold the key to the Mount of Olives where Jesus resurrected from. And here I am in an exorcist house with a holy woman who's my guest or my host. And, you know, I had arrived at this pathway through studying all these Aleister Crowley synchronicities, which is the Antichrist. So it's a fascinating journey. But to say synchronicity is something that I learned to appreciate more all the time. And what I've learned, as I've stated in the books, it's the precursor to the Tao, you know, T-A-O, the ancient Chinese verbiage for the way. Now, this has become very interesting because this is now leading me to Bulgaria, which is the homeland of Lao Tzu, according to what I'm learning. And I'll have to send you my newsletter, Leo. Email me and I'll send you my newsletter. And the same for you, George, because it features this stuff. And I've also been invited to China next year, so I'm going to be following some of the trails of Taoism from Bulgaria to Chinism. And Bulgarians is the source of many things the world's hidden up on. And I'll be updating this in my newsletter. It's a paid-for subscription for people out there in the audience. Montauk Pulse, you know, Skybooks, you can sign up on the website, which is www.skybooksusa.com. The Montauk Pulse, it's $15 a year plus shipping, whether you're in the United States or foreign, it's different. But I'll send that to you guys, just I'll send it to you on email if you email me.
A little geography, Peter, maybe for me and for others that are listening that can't remember. Now, Bulgaria, what country is directly to the east of them?
Well, to the east of Bulgaria is the ocean, or the sea. I think it's the Black Sea.
Black Sea. Okay.
I think it's the Caspian. I don't remember which sea it is. And it's not the Caspian. I don't remember. But I think it's the Black Sea, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it's the Black Sea. But it's right to the south of Romania, and it's right next to Turkey.
Okay. I'm just trying to remember where it was. Okay.
Yeah, it's right on the cusp of where Europe becomes Asia. It's in Europe, but barely. And, of course, it was a central point of where the Atlantean civilization came from, the Thracians. If you look up the Thracian Empire, and there are what I'm calling ruins and old monuments galore that nobody pays attention to. No historians pay attention to it. And I could sit there and say it, and nobody's gonna do it. Not even David Childress, who does alternative archaeology and anthropology, tremendous author, mm-hmm. tremendously prolific, and tremendously intelligent. He's a good friend of mine. He didn't know about any of this stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. So, I'll be seeing him later next month at the book fair in New York. But yes. So I'm saying this stuff is really it's. It's like the stuff in Kentucky. It's in plain sight, but nobody pays any attention to it.
Well, somebody has.
Not enough attention. And I'm talking about the academics.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But, Peter, don't cut yourself short. I mean, for years you've put your nose into this stuff, and you know it, just like the research and the research that you've put in your books and your materials. It's quite extensive, and there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, you go after – you get what you go after, and it's great because you see it with multi eyes, and it's great to be able to write about it too.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's coming on strong as we move into this 2012 period, whatever that represents. It's very exciting because it's streaming in at an alarming, a pleasantly alarming rate.
Peter, why do you think these areas have been ignored by traditional academics and researchers?
Well, you know, people just are steered and directed to pay attention to, first off, everybody has to be fed and clothed, and they have their attention on that. And then universities steer you into a consensus reality. This man in Bulgaria, he was given a scholarship because he's a great writer, and he said he had to quit after his first year because he said, if I continued studying there, I'm going to be virtually brainwashed, and I won't be able to think and write straight. You know, so I'm saying is it's like this is one of the problems is, you know, there's something to be said for an education and there's something else to be said for an education. So this is one of the problems is we're all victims of our own ignorance. And if we're using 90% of our 10% of our brain and leaving the other 90%, it's always been my idea to look after that 90%. And I couldn't tell you that I'm using 20, 40 or 50. I couldn't tell you what I'm using. I know I'm using more than the average 10. But it's like that's the whole goal, and you start exploring these subjects, and ultimately, and that's, I should add, we're just about ready to get out of time, but that's the whole theory of this white gold, this monoatomic is supposed to illuminate your brain, and it ties into the copper-based blood and whatnot. You're fully activated.
Okay.
We've got a few minutes while we're streaming, but the show, we can continue talking a little after that. Because the show gets recorded. But just for people who are listening, if you'd like to call in, you may talk to us, but if you'd like to call the number 646-915-9505, you can listen to the rest of the program. If not, we are about to lose our stream, but we want to thank everybody for listening, and definitely thank you, Peter and George. But... let's just to continue. Like I said, continue to record. But I wanted to ask you. I forgot what you were just talking about.
I was talking about the monoatomic white gold and how this is supposed to ignite both hemispheres of the brain and get it. You know, just like they turn up Frankenstein when he fights the Wolfman, they power him up to full strength before he fights the Wolfman in that Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman movie. This is powering up the human. That's a very funny example. But, you know, you're powering up the human to where he's operating on all cylinders. And most people... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Jim Mars, author. Do you know Jim's work?
I know of his work. Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic stuff. Rule by Secrecy, and of course, Alien Agenda, and so on. But he stated that on our show, actually, but he stated that the reason for the invasion of Iraq wasn't so much for the oil. The immediacy of that invasion was because Saddam Hussein actually had decoded from the Sumerian tablets. He actually just decoded the formula for anatomic gold, and they were doing experiments, and they found that if they put an ounce of anatomic gold into a pan, the pan would weigh, instead of weighing an ounce more, it would weigh an ounce less. So they found that these things, that this stuff was amazing, and was anti-gravity.
Yeah.
It was an anti-gravity formula that they came up with, and that they needed to go in and get the tablets, okay, the Sumerian tablets, which were stored in the Iraqi museum, which was looted. And he said the first thing that they did, regardless of, instead of securing the city or securing the area, the troops immediately went, first thing they got to was the Iraq museum.
And it was a special team that went down.
They looted all of the tablets were gone. And also there were over 10,000 tablets of Sumerian tablets with all of this information on it, and they had broken the code, they had broken the formulas, and to create this anatomic gold, and that was the weapons of mass destruction that people were, that supposedly was
that they were that really they were, referring that, to
exactly not you know, nuclear weapons and so on. It was this technology, or this antimatter that was at the crux of that invasion.
I wouldn't share his viewpoint. I think that sounds like a very absurd stream of disinformation. Because to think that Saddam Hussein was even that capable, or that competent, or that directed, is very hard for me to accept. But what I would say is that. I do know that the people that published the Spectrum had speculated about certain stargates and whatnot,
right.
About that scenario, which mimics what the Radu Sinemar book had said about this chamber. They found a similar chamber in Baghdad, like technology, but. The Iraqis hadn't really gotten it. It was the Americans who found out it was there and knew it was there and captured it, perhaps through their British intelligence people. So that was the invasion. Now, the Sumerian tablets are way predated by all this stuff in Bulgaria and Thracian stuff, which is the Bulgaria have stones which are the ancient hieroglyphics for Egypt. You can see how it comes back from Egypt, and it's pre-Sumerian. So this stuff, if I can ever get it out, I'll put a different light on the whole Sumerian preoccupation and fascination, which is certainly not irrelevant, but it predates it. Civilization is predated. It'll put a whole different spin because on these things. And, of course, when you get into those levels of government with Saddam Hussein, it's really hard to know. It's so hidden. It's so secret. And then you know, we have lies told about it by our governments. We have speculation, and that's clearly speculative. I mean, if it's true, it still can't be proven. It's in the realm of speculation.
They're probably still denying the Sphinx or the holographic the stuff that's in your book and the Transylvania.
That's a legend. I mean, it's technically a legend. It's a testimony of somebody who's seen it. We really don't know that it's true. It's
validated by a few people, but that's...
Well, if I can break in with Baghdad, understand that the Sumerian, even though the materials that you talk about, Peter, predate Sumerian text, But you know,
Well, Zachariah Sitchin's work, you're more or less talking about, right?
Yes. I mean, Zachariah Sitchin talks about the Anunnaki as the spaceport when they came to town was basically Baghdad area. And there are other bases, if you'd want to call it, you know, throughout the globe here, just like you have the Nazca lines down in South America. You know, these are different ports or different markings. But if nothing else, Zechariah Sitchin talked about Baghdad as being one of the landing ports of the comings and the goings of the Anunnaki. So, you know, the legend continues, but, you know, there is some focus on that. And, of course, you're dealing with the synchronicity, you know, it doesn't surprise me that it all links in together.
Yeah, there's no question that Baghdad was a hot spot. I mean, it's the cradle of civilization in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
In some way.
But a story is a story is a story, that's all. It's a fairy tale, but, you know, behind it there's some facts.
But you stated that there was a gateway. There's considered to be a gateway there, or a stargate, rather.
Well, that's what the Spectrum had published. And I know Al Bielek had offered a lot of information mm-hmm. about that. And, you know, it's clearly, I mean, I think we all know that there's multiple reasons why countries go to war. And, you know, it's interesting. I think what's important here is that we're learning as a people so much more about Babylon than say you would have in Sunday school. In other words, there's such more streams of information to give you different perspectives on what this story is about, because you get a very, I guess what you call a trite story when you hear the Sunday school stories. They're very trite, they're very dry, and they lack a lot of, what you call real human element.
Well, I remember, I got the quote here from your book, because I thought it, Babylon refers to the gateway of the lion.
Babylon means gate, Baba,
and lion.
Gateway, the gateway to the lion. Well, yeah, that's a whole other symbology I go into.
In fact, Shinar was the name of the capital, demonstrates that the principle of Shin, which you had mentioned before.
Yeah, the feminine. It was ancient, which a feminine, a center of repository of feminine energy,
right.
Which I stated in the...
I thought that was amazing how you wrapped that around, because and then got into the the olive tree, you know, which is why it was a major symbol of your cover actually on this book. But the when you dealt with the olive tree and the sacred olive oil, right, and saying that you mentioned that the Ark of the Covenant was actually the wings were actually or the you know the symbolic of the seraphim, I guess, were carved in olive wood, right?
Yeah.
I have to say I highly recommend anybody to read Montauk Book of the Living, and of course Transylvanian Sunrise and the other Montauk series, because
the doors were covered with olive wood, and I think depending on what version you read.
Well,
you know, some of the wings, yeah.
And the essence of life was the olive oil, you know, which was
it creates the spark for the Shekinah, which is the glory, the Shekinah glory, which is the thing that comes as the spark out of the mercy seat in the Ark of the Covenant, and that spark is the. It's the fire. It's the element of fire. It's the spark of life, and of course the Shekinah is the dwelling. It's the feminine principle, and only the high priest could see this once a year. And of course, I look at it quite amusingly as a Pez dispenser. It's like this is the most vital substance in the universe, but it's all sequestered and there's no distribution on it. It's just sitting there, and only the priest can look at it, and everybody else is a blank Hulk.
Right.
You know,
it's hysterical. It's ridiculous, isn't it? How sensitive that is, and that was the power of the feminine, and that was in that the feminine essence, and
it's restricted, and see this is the thing. So when it's unleashed, it literally scares the living daylights out of the status quo. And of course, in the Eastern arts, we know this is Tantra, or the emanations of the feminine. You know, women who practice Tantra will have, you know, jolts of energy going through their body. And men will have it too, but it's different for the female. And it's like if women as a whole were experiencing this, we'd have battery chargers that are just going on just pure, beautiful, feminine psychic energy that's going to literally heal the planet in its own.
There you have it.
Yeah.
I agree, but I your book was a delight, and
I hope the listeners buy it because you really
the Montauk
really
book
need
that
to read
reading,
it.
It was remarkable, but I suggest that you read the whole Montauk series because it's just it's a mind blowing collection of works.
Leo, this would be a good. Leo, this would be a good time to tell you what's coming up next. Is I'm trying to get the sequel to Transylvania Sunrise translated.
Good.
Yes, great.
And this features where Radu goes to Transylvania, where he's transported. I think it's to Tibet or China, where he finds these ancient tantric manuscripts, and it concerns getting them translated by the character in the book, who's Dr. Zen, who turns out he's a Tibetan Lama, and he translates these manuscripts for him.
Oh,
so this is part of that same theme we were just talking about, and I have not read the book. I've only been given a summation of it, which I include in the Transylvania Sunrise, but I'm looking forward because it ties in the Transylvania connection again as well.
Right.
So am I.
Yeah, I really, really look forward to that. Will that be out next year or this year or what?
I got to get it translated, and as soon as I get it translated, then I put it into production.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put a timetable. I would hope if everything goes well, I would imagine I'd have it by January, but that's guesswork.
Well, we hope so.
Something to look forward to next year. But
well, at this point, it's a focus point.
It certainly is.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show at such short notice, and I believe that was strongly a synchronicity.
Without a doubt.
And then George calling me at the exact minute the funny thing was, the minute that you accepted my friendship request, George called. All right.
Well, that's great synchronicity. Remember both of you to email me so I can send you the latest newsletter.
We definitely
will do.
I'll email you tonight. And your email is what now?
Skybooks@yahoo.com.
Yahoo, okay. All right.
Well, we thank you very much for being on the show, and it was fascinating, Peter, as always. We really enjoyed listening to you very much.
Yeah,
it was a pleasure to talk to you all again.
Thank you, George.
And George, as always, a great pleasure to have you on. And
Peter, God be with you, my friend. Thank you.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
And thank you, Lyle, and Lila and Leo.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You guys are great.
All right. You too, man.
Good night.
Thank you
God
so
be
much.
With you.
Good night. And peace there, buddy. You were still with us, George?
Yeah.
George just left.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I want to thank everybody being on tonight, George and Peter. And, check out Peter Moon's site. His website is Skybooks, skybooksusa.com. And check out the Montauk series. One of the books we were talking about tonight was the Montauk Book of the Living. I want to check out the Montauk Book of the Dead as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the first one. And then you look at the, there's six or seven books. There's over six or seven books in the series, yeah. And they were written by Preston Nichols and by Peter Moon and others translated and co-written. This particular one, the Montauk Book of the Living, was written by Peter Moon. And it talks about his great journey as he discovers the different links and different paths to the knowledge that he's acquired over these years, and he's been on a tremendously amazing spiritual journey, and highly recommend his books. And that's the best I can tell you. Good night, everybody, and hope you join us next week. Tell your friends about this show too, and good night.